Hey there, thanks for venturing beyond the Rotunda, a Farmingdale Public Library podcast, where today we will talk about madness, mayhem, and the macabre, and ask the question, what is it that scares you? I am your narrator, Kevin Schultz. Let's carve this one up. This is episode 3 of the Beyond the Rotunda podcast, a production of the Farmingdale Public Library, where we are more than just books. And as we are recording this, we are right smack dab in the middle of spooky season. And that's why I sat down with local Long Island author George Gross III. We discussed his action-packed crime novel, Payback, as well as his horror short story collections, A Look Inside a Mangled Mind. But before we get to that interview, as we always do, let's check out our cover questions. Last time I asked you, if you could, would you prefer to flash back to your past or flash forward to your future? And I got some pretty good responses, like this one from Karen from Farmingdale, who says she would prefer to flash back to her past because she misses her paternal grandmother very much, and she would love to revisit that time they spent together at the Cloisters. Stu from Bethpage says he would like to flash forward to his future so he can check out how good his kids are doing. He wants to make sure they're going to be happy. Next, we have Laura from Plainview, who said she would like to flash back to her past because she's fearful that flashing forward would be too confusing to her life in real time. Plus, she would like the opportunity to give her recently deceased parents just one more hug. Donna from Massapequa Park would also like to flash back to her past. This would give her the opportunity to tell her family members who have passed away, especially her father, just how much she loves them. And finally, we have Christine from St. Augustine, Florida. Our reach is growing far and wide. And Christine says she would flash forward to her future simply because she's already lived her past, and she's much more interested and curious about what lies ahead. It seemed the overriding sentiment was flashing back to our pasts to see our loved ones again, but we definitely got some interesting viewpoints on flashing forward, and I thank everyone for writing in. Now let's move on to today's cover question, which is, from a literary or cinematic standpoint, what is it that scares you? For me, I've always been a horror film fan. I grew up during the Halloween, Friday the 13th, A Nightmare on Elm Street era. And as a kid, those movies are scary. As I got older, I still do watch horror, mostly with my stepdaughter. But I have lost my vision. So those jump scares and the gore really doesn't do anything for me anymore. What still does do it, though, is the music. When that eerie score kicks in, I still get that worried anticipation because I know something horrific is about to happen. From a literary standpoint, it's the idea of isolation that gets to me. If someone is alone at night in their house, or lost in the woods, or walking down a dark, deserted street, that's when the tension can set in for me. Especially if I'm reading that alone in my own house at night, and I begin to hear all the noises around me. The house settling, the tree branch outside rustling in the wind. It can be terrifying. So that's what scares me. What say you? What scares are in your book? Send us your thoughts to beyondtherotunda@farmingdalelibrary.org. And now we can turn the page towards our interview with George Gross III. And that is, of course, G-E-O-R-G-E, G-R-O-S-S-I-I-I. And I'll tell you a quick story. I've always been an aspiring author. And when my wife, who works at a local coffee house that George Gross frequents, found out that he is, in fact, an author himself, she wanted the two of us to meet. Now, when I got the gig here at the library, hosting this podcast, I asked my wife to find out if George would be interested in appearing as a guest. And obviously he was, because you're about to hear him. But that same day that we asked him, he went home to have dinner with his wife, and he told her the story. And when he was done, he cracked open his fortune cookie, and he pulled out the slip, and he read his fortune, which said, "Respect and help from influential people is on your way." Now, that's a great fortune, and that's a great story. I don't know how influential we are here at Beyond the Rotunda just yet, but we definitely do respect our guests, and we would do what we can do to help them get that BTR bump. And for George Gross, that starts today with his interview. I do hope you enjoy it. Once again, we are visiting with Long Island author George Gross III, and George has lived quite the life. He is a musician. He has been in law enforcement. He has been in the military. He is an engineer. And of course, he is an author. George currently has 5 books to his credit, the first being a standalone novel called Payback, and the other 4 are part of a short story collection called Inside a Mangled Mind. And today we're going to dare take a peek inside that mangled mind. George, welcome, and thanks for venturing beyond the rotunda.
Oh, good morning, and that's a nice intro.
What we like to do here is start off by giving our guest the opportunity to answer our cover question, which is a conversation starter that I ask at the beginning of each episode. And since we are still in the middle of spooky season, George, from a literary and or cinematic standpoint, what is it that scares you?
What scares me?
Yes.
Well, I think I was told I wasn't allowed to say my wife, but no, what scares me is that the stuff that becomes too real, like the stuff I try to write. If it's too far-fetched and too out there, it's more, to me, not as scary as something that could be, like, way too real. So Hannibal Lecter, even though it's, you know, very fictionalized, is more scary than, you know, like Freddy Krueger.
Right.
You know, Michael Myers and all those guys. Yeah, they're fun movies. They make for a good afternoon or whatever. But what really scares me is the, you know, that it could be the mild next-door neighbor that is the worst person you'll ever meet.
Right.
So the more real it becomes and the more real it makes you feel is what scares me.
That makes sense. For me, it's always been that idea of isolation. You know, so the person alone in the house or in the woods, or they're walking down that desolate street at night and you hear footsteps behind them, that gives me that eerie feeling.
Right. I understand that too.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when I was in between bands way back in the late 70s, I got a job. I was a night watchman at a factory.
Okay.
Go from 11 to 7 with nobody in the factory in that little guard booth with nothing around for miles. And I chose one night to read The Shining.
Oh, not a good choice.
So after a while, every little noise, I was looking around like, what was that? What was that?
Yep.
So I fully get that.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Yes. So before we get into your writing, I figured we'd get to know you a little bit better by going through some of your past experiences.
Sure.
And you've already touched on it. You are a musician. So what music do you play? What instruments do you play?
Well, I'm a trumpet player, flugelhorn player, and also play keyboards. And majority of the time I was playing horn, so I was a sideman for different bands all over the place and traveling all over this country and playing with, you know, variety of people from, you know, major stars to, you know, local, you know, wedding band kind of stuff.
Right.
I prefer more of when I play my music on the keyboard, it's more like progressive rock stuff, more like a Yes, Kansas, Emerson, Lake and Palmer
right
genre stuff. My horns, I lean way more towards like the like a fusion jazz kind of stuff.
okay
And big band stuff, you know, like the Maynard Ferguson bands and
right
you know, that sort of thing is where I go with that.
Well, the big bands are made for the horn section, so yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Even bands, there was a band that there was a trumpet player, Bill Chase, who came out of like Woody Herman's big band.
Right.
And he has his own band called Chase. Unfortunately, he died in the early 70s. But that was like a blood, sweat, and tears with a 4-piece horn section that would knock your socks off. And that was a phenomenal band. It's one of my favorite things to listen to.
Right. And you mentioned a little bit, it's name drop time. Is there anybody that you've played with that we might know?
Well, again, yeah, I got to sit with the Maynard Ferguson band, Clark Terry, Buddy Rich. When I was on the West Coast, we did a benefit concert, and there was people there, like the Tower Power Horn section, Mick
Right.
Gillette and Stevie Wonder was there, those kind of guys. So I've got to sit in and play with a lot of, big name
That's
people. A lot of fun.
pretty cool, yeah. Now, how do you transition from music into law enforcement?
Well, after a couple of years on the road and getting tired of bands breaking up and being stuck in remote cities, I figured it was time to get a real job and do music on the side, since I realized then that I wasn't going to be the next big name guy.
Right.
So you realize that at some point. So you just, say, all right, now I need a real job. So I got a job doing that to pay the bills and play music on the side.
Right.
And after a few years of that, it was like, no, this ain't for me. So I went into the service. I went into the Navy.
Right, that
And
was going to be my next question.
yeah,
So
did the
you were in
Navy.
the Navy.
Yep, and I did what I needed to do there. I ran nuclear reactors. I was an ET nuke. And when I came out, I got into the R&D engineering world. And unfortunately, 30 years later, I moved myself up to or down to, depending on how you look at it, designing some very high-tech printed circuit boards for the military.
Now, you learned your engineering skills through the military?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Too many schools.
Yeah.
At the first year and a half was almost all school.
Wow.
And they say
Wow.
that the Naval Nuclear Power School is one of the toughest schools in the country. It's basically a 4-year nuclear science degree in about 6 months.
Intense.
Yeah. I mean, they take out, you don't have to have the English courses or
Right.
the cooking skills courses.
Right.
It's all physics and heat transfer and thermal dynamics and electronics and heavy maths and all that kind of stuff. So you get, the nuclear degree pretty much without the fluff that makes up a degree when you get it from other schools.
Right. Well, thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you.
And now, of course, you are an author, which is
I'm
the main
trying to
reason why
be.
you're here. Yeah, you're published.
Yeah, I used to
And
say that, people would say, because a lot of my friends heard about me writing for decades. And they said, oh, you're an author. I said, well, not technically not yet. I said, until you publish and somebody purchased it, you're just a hack.
right.
So I was that for way too long.
I'm still a hack.
So I guess technically I have sold. So I guess I am an author at this point.
Absolutely. So now let's go into your writing.
Okay.
Give us your book jacket summary of your novel, Payback.
Well, Payback was the my first attempt at a novel, and I think it went pretty well. A lot of good positive reviews. Most people that read it seem to really enjoy it. I get told often that it's in the vein of like a Lethal Weapon kind of movie kind of thing.
Right.
And so the book jacket reads, Bill Anderson had been a U.S. Navy SEAL. Now he is a tough New York City cop running a narcotics team. He was good at his job, maybe too good. The drug dealers had connections to the top and had him suspended. They tried to kill him. They ruined his life. Now it was his turn. Payback time has just begun.
Nice. It's got a hook to it. I like
I
it.
was hoping that was the, yeah, that's what you want to try to do, I think, is on a jacket, you don't want to give too much away.
Right.
You want to give him something that'll slap him in the eye and then make him want to read it.
Yep. And did you write the book jacket yourself?
Yes, I did.
Good job.
Oh, thanks. See,
Now, how?
that's the hard part with the short story collections. There's like 12 short stories. You can't synopsize all of them
Right.
on the
Well,
thing. So
that was my next question. How would you describe A Look Inside a Mangled Mind?
well, that's the thing. You have to strategically pick, which stories you're going to touch on. And it basically says, like the first volume says, The Look Inside a Mangled Mind, Volume 1, is a collection of 12 stories. And it goes on and it lists like three or four of them. Those are the ones I thought would be the ones that would really grab, a reader's attention
Right.
and, give them something that they'd want to see or want to go into deeper.
Right.
That's like you said, it's setting the hook. It's like a fish. You put the bait out there, and once you set the hook, you hope they're going to finish it.
Now, what kind of stories can readers expect?
Well, Look Inside a Mangled Mind series are mostly fairly shocking and violent serial killer stuff. and and obviously the police that go after them, so there are,
Right.
very good law enforcement people involved. But predominantly it's kind of like a Criminal Minds meets a Saw kind of stuff, or a
Right.
Dexter kind of thing. So they are very graphic as far as the violence inside, but the overall is good against evil, and I hope the good people, preside over at the end.
In the end, right?
But because of that, and because I know it's not for everybody, I did throw in a handful of what I call nice stories. And pretty much those are in there to cleanse your palate, or
Right.
a shower for your soul, as I like to say.
Right.
Because once you read two or three hard ones, it's hard to you can't sit down and read all 12 of them in a row, because it would just like your mind wouldn't be able to take it.
Exactly.
So you got to read a short story, and then you read another one the next day. So then you're like, man, that guy was really messed up. And you go to the next one, and it's, oh, this is a nice story. Okay, now I can go again. You get that,
Yes.
you get that break in the tension and the assault on your senses.
Right. Recharge the batteries. Yep. Now, you've predominantly written short stories. What took you down that path?
Well, that was an interesting thing. When I first finished my novel, I started looking around to try to get it out there, and almost everybody told me the same thing. There's no publishing houses wanted unsolicited material. You had to go through an agent. All the agents are in the city. They're an hour and a half away. I had very little control over anything that may or may not happen there. And I just felt that wasn't a path for me. So in looking around, I found a few short story writing competitions that would give you that opportunity, where the top couple of people got looked at by publishers along the way. So I said, ah, I can write short stories. And the hard part about that, and the good thing about that, was they had word limits. So I would write a short story and I'd be fairly over that word limit.
Right.
They say 5,000 words and I'm up in the 5,400, 5,500 word count.
Right.
So all of a sudden I have to go through 12 pages and eliminate 500 words. And even though that was what I initially felt that was very bad from a writing point of view, now I got to cut all this good stuff out.
Right.
What I thought was good stuff. What I did was it forced me to go back and edit it in a way to make my writing more concise and more story driven as opposed to word driven. So I would cut out a lot of the fluff, I
The
would say,
fluff,
the
right?
flowery stuff. I don't need to describe the policeman's office or the detective's office, because everybody has watched TV or a movie and have seen that.
Right.
They know what it looks like on Law and Order, or Criminal Minds, or
Right.
NCIS, or a million movies that you've seen over the years. They all know what those look like. So saying he went in and threw it on top of his messy desk, to me, was enough. I didn't have to go into it was a gray filing cabinet and the coffee stained carpet and
Exactly.
the unpainted moldy gray walls. I mean, by cutting all that out, I think it made the stories flow better. And could do it in a shorter time frame and really make it, to me, a better story in the end. So even though it hurt in the beginning, because I was like, oh, how am I cutting all this good stuff out? When I went back, it was actually turned out to me, I thought it was a better story at the end.
Yeah.
So that forced me, and as the time went on, writing 20, 30, 40 short stories, that process redefined how I was as a writer, which then,
Right.
when I went back and I said, you know what, my editor actually said you should go ahead and you should self-publish the short stories, get them out there, and you'll see what kind of reception you get. So that was tough. Now I had to put them in a book and do all the other stuff involved with this whole process. So I had to
Right.
learn a lot of that stuff. But once it was out there, and I did get good positive feedback from friends, coworkers, even strangers online that I don't know. And all of a sudden, it was just like, wow, maybe I can get this novel out there. So I went back to re-edit it. And I found that it took about a year, because I went back and I really re-edited it the way I write today. So I got rid of more of that other stuff and
Right.
what I consider a better writing technique now. To clean it all up, and I think it was a good thing in the end.
Yeah, that's a fascinating process.
Yeah, kind of backwards process, but it worked.
Yeah. So now, with all of these short stories, you've developed a vast collection of work.
Yes.
How much has your past experience in law enforcement and in the military helped develop those story ideas?
Well, you get to see different sides of everything. So that helps with that. In the prison system, there was, I ended up on the mental health ward where all the quote unquote criminally insane people were, or where
Right.
the emotionally disturbed people were. So I got to see that even though they looked normal on the outside, when you cracked open that cookie,
Right.
something, dark and festering underneath. So in a way to help me understand that mindset. So when I started writing, what would a serial killer do, or what would a thing person like that want to do, I did have
Right.
a slight look into what the real ones really were. And then, of course, you have other influences like the Hannibal Lecters and the millions of other,
Yes.
movies and stuff over the decades that you watch from a little kid all the way up.
Right.
But my dad had gotten me started with the mysteries when I was a kid. He was, big into like the Dashiell Hammetts and the Agatha Christies and the Arthur Conan Doyles. So all of that
Okay.
stuff influenced me from that point of view, from the cop and the mystery and the
Right.
bad guys.
That's a good place to
So
start. Yeah.
I started young.
Right. Now, I know they're all good, but it is Sophie's Choice time. If you
Uh-oh.
had to pick one story to recommend to a new reader to introduce yourself, which would you pick?
That's a tough one to ask.
Yep.
There's a lot of at least I consider them I consider them all pretty good.
That's right.
I guess there's a few that would, jump out as a good tell for there's a couple of them that go on, and that's a problem when you say that. Because I would say justifiable homicide, but that's in multiple books and multiple things.
Right.
But to get a good feel, in volume four, there's a story called Menagerie. That would be a good one to jump in to get a good feel for. And also, there's another one in volume three called No Strings. And that's
Okay.
another a good one that I like to go to. That's a good one.
Give us a little idea what Menagerie is about.
Well, that's kind of a tough one to really put a thing on. Let's just think about it as human fish tanks.
Okay.
If that makes
That's
sense. It's
intriguing.
yeah, exactly. And that's I would hate to give away too much more than that.
Sure. What about No Strings?
No Strings is kind of a twisted puppeteer, all
Okay.
right, where he kidnaps people and makes them into pretty much marionettes while they're still alive.
All right.
So it's pretty intense.
Very interesting.
So there are a variety of stories, different, but again, it's all in a similar genre.
Which we're going to get to now. So, writing short stories
Yes.
does allow you to write in different genres. You do tend to focus on the macabre, though. So, do you consider yourself a horror writer?
I would probably say yes.
Okay.
Been reading and all the way back to the Clive Barker days and the early Stephen King days and the H.P. Lovecraft and
Right.
Arthur Danzani and those kind of guys, Edgar Allan Poe, of course, and watching all the Vincent Price movies and the Lon Chaney movies. And that
Right.
was, that was the thing that tickled me when I was young and growing up and kept it alive. And for better or worse, when I was dating my wife, we would go to Blockbuster on a, that's, you know, I'm dating myself. We'd go to Blockbuster on a Friday night or a Saturday night, and we'd get three movies, and she would insist that two of them had to be horror movies. So
Oh,
she was
that's
a
a great
bad in,
match.
yes. So in a way, she was a bad influence on me. But also let me know that anything I did was fine with her.
Right,
And
right.
After I get, when I write a story and I finish the story and I edit it 15, 20 times until I'm really convinced that I'm done with it, she's the first one that sees it. And the majority of the time, she's like, wow, that's pretty wild, you know. So most of the time she's good. There have been times she said, you know what, you know, go back on this thing because I think you could have did this area a little better, or maybe it should have been better if they did this. And so she has given, you know, pointers like that, and I've taken that under counsel.
Yeah, that's it's important to have that constructive criticism from somebody you trust.
Right. And the worst one was, I mentioned like a trilogy of stories called Justifiable Homicide. The first two are out. The third one is in the forthcoming volume, which will probably be next summer at some time. But at the end of the second story, I, you know, killed off the bad guy. So when she got to the end of that, she was like, "What are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "This is a great character. You can't kill him off. You got to bring him back again." So I had to go back and rewrite the end of that story in a way that his escape or getting away, or however you want to call that, his freedom, worked in a way that could work for the story. So
Made
I
sense, right?
yeah, I had to rewrite the end of that, you know, a little bit to get there. And like I said, the third story in that one is finished, but not out there yet because I'm still working on volume five. I'm a little more than halfway through it, so hoping by next summer that'll be out.
Now, as a horror writer, I once heard author Christopher Golden say that horror writers are working out something personal within themselves. So I have to ask you, George, what's wrong with you?
Yeah,
What's your
exactly.
issue?
It's funny because some coworkers that have read the stories come to me and says, "How do you come up with this stuff?" I said, "Well, you see where I work, right?" So that's that. But no, I don't know. I guess because I was influenced so young with the mysteries and the horror, that's just a part of me. And you know, my older sister and brother-in-law have been in the medical field since the early 70s. So when I would come up with, you know, whatever the bad guy was going to do to the victims, besides my research online and, you know, that kind of effort that I put into things, I would call them up and say, "Hey, I want to do this, and this is what I'm thinking." And my first thing my sister usually says is, "Why do you want to do that?" And I said, "Well, I'm not doing it technically. I'm writing about doing it. It's not like I'm out there, you know, physically doing this thing to people." So it's more of a writing exercise, or however you want to call it. Is it cathartic? I don't know. I hope I'm not that deranged where this would, you know, someday I'll snap and this will become true. That would be kind of wild.
Not so far.
I'm usually the jovial guy. I'm the one that's cracking all the bad groan or one-liners, you know.
To me, horror elicits tension, fear, and dread. I would like you to read the opening paragraph to your short story. What do we call it?
Oh, The Last Angel.
The Last Angel.
Okay,
Because I
that.
believe that encapsulates all that horror has to offer in just that one little passage.
Okay, let me dig it out here. There, yeah, that's the opening story in volume two. And yeah, I guess the first two paragraphs would do you justice. All right, so this is The Last Angel. It's funny. No matter how many times I do this, they always seem to make me smile. They all react the same way. When they feel the gloved hand clamp over their mouths, their eyes snap open in terror and their bodies go stiff for about 3 seconds. Then their survival instincts kick in. They try to buck me off of them, but I'm usually planted firmly, trapping their arms and legs under the blankets they once relied on for warmth. I show her the syringe and press on the plunger to arc a little fluid out of the tip to show her that it's real. Smiling, I jab her in the shoulder and continue to hang on until she goes limp. This usually takes between 5 and 10 seconds until they are completely under with no chance of waking up before I am ready for them. She is the fourth one that I want to keep. Yes, I have gotten rid of a few too. She should be happy.
I think that's great.
Thank you.
But it leads me to the question, if these elements, tension, fear, and dread, do in fact embody horror, why do you think so many people, of which I am one, enjoy horror so much?
I think it's the endorphins. I think because when you're reading it, or if it's on TV or in a movie or something like that, or even on the news when you're watching something like the Gilgo Killer or the Menendez Brothers or
Right.
the that kind of the BTK guy, you see it on the news. It's not happening to you, but you get emotionally attacked by that, and it's the endorphins that kick in. That, like any other sexual pleasure-driven thing,
Right.
and that adrenaline is tough to get rid of. That's why people jump off cliffs with those little flying squirrel suits.
Right.
It's that, it is the fear. It is that
Yeah.
adrenaline thing. I could crash. I could die. I could fall. I could hit a tree. You know, you go
Yep.
skiing down a cliff. Most people get down the cliff on the skis fine. Every once in a while, something happens and they break a leg. Other times people hit a tree and don't survive. So there is a thrill, and that's the thing. You know, it's, oh my God, what did he do?
Yeah.
They're digging up another body. Oh my God. He did what to, he had her trapped in a closet for how long? You know?
There's that thin line between fear and pleasure.
Right.
And when
And
it's not happening to you
right.
necessarily in a book, you know.
Right, because it's antiseptic. It's because it's not happening to you or your neighbor or your wife or your daughter or your
Right.
brother or your cousin. It's very antiseptic when it's in a book or a movie. It's
Right.
not that touching, but it's thrilling. That's why people take roller coasters, and they make the roller coaster today more bizarre than they
Right.
were. You know, you go back and look at the Coney Island, you know, roller coaster. You look at it now, you're like, really? People got thrilled by this?
Yep.
Because now you got these one where you're hanging upside down and
Yes.
flying backwards and upside down and around at 40 miles an hour, jumping over
Yeah.
something. I mean, it's just insane.
I can't do it.
So I think that's all it is. It's a pleasure thrill that kicks in the endorphins, and you get that ride. And
Right.
there is a come down after that. You go to a very intense movie, or you go, read through a very intense book that lasts. Well, a short story lasts 15 minutes, but if you read like a, you're sitting there for 3 hours or 4 hours, and you really plow through a, you know, a full novel like that,
Right.
there's a come down because you are so thrilled and you are so turned on, that adrenaline pump. Half an hour later, you're ready to sleep because your body comes down off of that. So.
And what I've been able to read of your work, you do get into the details on the forensics, on the medicals, on the weaponry.
Yep.
These details can be graphic.
Yeah, yes, they can.
Is there a line that you won't cross? Is there anything that's too much for you?
It's hard to say. I haven't yet. I did one thing in one story. I won't tell you about it now. That I, to me, I felt I almost crossed the line, and it did bother me a little bit that I did write it. But generally speaking, again, because it is antiseptic, it's not me really physically doing it to somebody.
Right.
I get to have that, you know, non-exposure, you know, that I can do these things without doing these things, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, I do the research. I'm online all the time. I'm on forensic sites. I'm on the FBI site. I'm on, yeah, medical sites, forensic sites, blood analysis sites, the FBI sites, all those sorts of things. When you're looking, not so much for ideas, what you're looking for is how would, you know, what can I do with like a blood splatter thing? And you see it, or you hear it on the, you read it in books, or you see it in movies or TV. Oh, well, the blood arced like this, so that had to be, you know, arterial spray, or that or the blunt force trauma was in this direction, but the splatter on the wall came from the hammer or the bat or whatever it is that hit that person, you know.
Right.
When it came back, it was cast off. And, you know, when blood drops, if it blood drops straight down, it makes a circular pattern on the floor.
Okay.
If it's moving, it makes like a teardrop shape. And from
Makes
that,
sense, right?
they can tell you which direction the blood was moving, which means which direction it came from, which means that it happened, you know, if it looks like it came from the right, it happened to the right. So that sort of stuff. So you get, you know, you have to use that in the book. I mean, if you write stuff that's not realistic, like you asked before, the more real I can make it, or make it seem, the more it will affect you because you're picturing it happening to you or your wife or your neighbor or your boss. You can picture that stuff happening. So as soon as you picture it, it becomes real in your head. So the more real I can make it, if you know it's, you know Freddy Krueger isn't real. So what he's doing to somebody is one thing, but you know he's not a real thing. Where the mild-mannered neighbor, you're like everybody around the guy in where is he, Levittown or whatever from the Gilgo Beach. Everybody's like, really, him? He's such a nice guy. How could it possibly be him? But that's the ones, like they say, it's a, what do they always say? Oh, he was such a nice, quiet guy. Always polite, kept to himself.
Yes,
Well,
yes. That realism and accuracy can be scary.
right. So the more real I make it seem, the more real it affects you. Either you like it or you don't. But if you do like it, you'll come back for the next story. If I make it, too abstract or too unrealistic, they're going to be like, come on, really? This is stupid. I'm not going to read this. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about. So the more real I think I can make it with that information, I think it makes a better story.
Makes sense to me. In some cases, you have written a series within the Inside a Mangled Mind series itself.
Yes.
With
There's
that
the
in mind, can you see any of your characters leading their own full-length novel?
Interesting question. I this is probably a couple of them in there that I don't know about a specific character, but there's probably a couple of the detective teams I think could be, morphed into something that would be a full length thing, because I have reused, even though they're not connected stories, I've reused like the detectives from, this story. Oh yeah, I like that detective. They would be good for this one. But reuse detectives like you would watching a serial on TV, Law and Order, same guys, different stories every week, not really connected other than they're in the same office.
Same protagonist, different antagonist.
Right. So I have used that. I do have, like I said, the Justifiable Homicide. There's two stories out there. The third one will forthcoming, but there was the Detective Matthews trilogy that, carried three guys over. And something like that could. There are a few characters I've considered doing, for lack of a better term, a prequel or a backstory on that could be developed into something more, like that.
Very good. In all of your work, who's been your favorite character to write?
Oh, that's a tough one, because I do like a lot of them.
You should.
Right, yeah, I do like a lot of them. When you're writing a story or a book, to me, you have to get in. You're into the characters. You become very emotionally involved and connected to these characters, good and bad. But you do. You like this is you put stuff into them. So there are some, the bad guy characters that are pretty intense, and there's a couple of detectives that I thought were pretty good. I think my favorite detective was just a story called Crandall, and that's the detective's name, and he's a pretty good character. So I could see maybe thinking about doing something for him in the long run.
Is that the name of the story itself as
Yes, it
well?
is, and it's a story in hang on a second. It's in volume one. It's a story called Crandall, and it's about that detective. So I could see, developing that character prior to this story.
See where he came from.
How he got to where he is. And it wouldn't technically be a prequel. You'd just be writing a longer piece that dealt with him in the past, I guess. So that when you got to this story, you'd go like, oh, okay, now I know what that is. How we got to that stage, how we got to this point without making it seem like that's what I did.
I look forward to that if you ever do
Yeah, me too.
it. This might be a difficult question, but how about the most difficult character to write?
It's the most difficult ones, believe it or not, are the good guys. The bad guys, you can, they, I'm going to say they have an agenda, for lack of a better term, whatever it is in their thing that makes them want to do what they're doing. That's an agenda. You have that, it locked up and okay, I need a guy that's going to be doing A, B, and C. So that's the easy thing to write because you know those three scenarios or those three incidents are going to make up their story. It's writing the good guys in a way that weaves in and out between all of that has to make sense. So you have to come up with all the clues or the information for them to follow, or the breadcrumbs, or the strings, whatever it is that makes them follow. And you have to do that in a way that makes sense. You can't, again, you can't write it too unrealistic. Or, what's he got? ESP? What's he, you can't do that. You have to do it in a way that makes sense. And sometimes that's the hardest thing, is making sense in between the madness.
Without giving the story away.
Right. So you kind of have to, like, you can have a good detective, but making them, her or he, fit and make sense going weaving through is the hard part sometimes.
So you mentioned this a little bit before, but who are some of your influences? Who did you grow up reading?
Well, I like that. I like my dad got me started early with the mystery, so I could, once I was, able to read past like the, Curious George and the, Hardy Boys. Once I was up to like that level, he was giving me like the Agatha Christies, he was giving me the Dashiell Hammetts, he was giving me the Arthur Conan Doyle, so the, Sherlock Holmes and Sam Spade and, Miss Marple and all those things are what I grew up on. And that led me to Poe, because he was like the first detective story. And so that led me to Poe. That was more, you can't say horror like it was, like it is today, but it was more
Dark.
horrific and, yeah, dark and, psychologically upsetting to people back in the day. You got to remember, that's almost 200 years ago already, right? So that was something that affected them. So I got a kick out of that, believe it or not. I like, wow, that's really cool. That made me feel something different. And so I started going down that road. So I started reading like the Poes and the I found Lovecraft and the creepy stories and all that kind of stuff is where I kept both alive because you can see I'm still doing detective stories. But the horror stuff came along, and then by the time the 80s came around and you had the Clive Barkers, and then 90s came around and you had Harris, and you had the Stephen King thrown in there for years, and then Peter Straubs, and all those kind of guys.
You mentioned them. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you have a story that you pay homage to Lovecraft.
Yes, I do. It's oh geez, I can't even think of the title of it, but it's in the fourth volume.
Is it something about the eyes, right?
Yes. Yeah,
Inside the eyes or
it's with my own eyes.
with my own eyes.
And I had written that back in high school. So I wrote that over 40 years ago. And oh my God, 47 years ago at least. And that was a story that, I just, it was a cool story, but what do you do with it? You just, it was in a briefcase or printed out on a piece of paper somewhere for decades. And then one day I was sitting around saying, wow, I should dig out some of my old stuff. And I dug around, and there's a couple of stories. A couple of them I am going to have to go back and really, flesh out, or whatever you want to call it. But this one was actually good, and it was pretty close. So I went back and I tweaked it the way I write now. And if you read it before and you read it now, you'd probably say, wow, you didn't really change a lot. I don't know if that's what that says, if I was a better writer at 18 than I was when I was 50. I lost something, but
It was a start.
right. So I just tweaked it up a little bit and I put it out there. So it was written 47 years ago and then finally saw the light of day. So
Yeah, I enjoyed that one.
yes, it was like a dark, twisted, labyrinthine thing that a Lovecraft story would would carry. So I,
It took you on a ride.
yes. So I was like, you know what? It's written like him. I'll tweak it a little bit to make it sound more in that vein. And I think it did the job.
I agree.
So,
So what are you working on now? You mentioned this a little bit, but what are you working on now?
well, I have like five stories for volume five. I have two more in the works, but I'm looking at it. It probably needs 9 or 10, so I still got a couple more stories to come up with.
Right.
And I also have a second novel in the works that's maybe a third of the way in.
Oh, nice.
But between life and work and home and everything else, it gets harder and harder to find time to write. So when you do, it's, if I have 2 hours, I want to do that for a short story rather than spending 2 hours on a half a chapter for a novel that,
Right.
you really need more time to sit down to work on a novel.
What's the novel about?
Well, it's the same characters, well, the same good characters from Payback,
Okay.
but in a completely separate story. They could be read independently. You don't need to know the first one to read the second one. But it's the same characters, so it's the
Right.
same good guys again facing a wall of monsters that they have to overcome. So,
Sounds good. Look forward to it.
and it's like the first one, it's like a lethal weapon. So it has these funny lines. It'll make you laugh.
Right.
There's some good sex scenes that'll make you blush. There is,
Right.
obviously cops and robbers, so they shoot them up, blow them up. There is some violence, but I tame that violence so it's not like it is in the horror ones.
Right.
More mainstream.
And where can our listeners find your books?
Well, they can go to my website, which is www.georgegrossiii.com, or they can look for me on Amazon. Same name.
That's right. That's great. I like to end by asking a question. Is there anything that you wished I had asked, but I didn't?
No, I actually I think this was fun. This went well. So I had a good time.
That's great. But we're not done.
Uh-oh.
In the infamous words of Jigsaw, I want to play a game.
Okay.
And we're going to call that this game. Pick your storyline.
Okay.
I'll give you the scenario. You pick the path you would choose.
Okay.
So are you ready? In the wake of an unfortunate accident, would you prefer to convalesce with Nurse Annie Wilkes from Misery or Nurse Mildred Ratchet from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Ooh, that's a very interesting one, because both have completely different dynamics.
Yes.
I would to make it easier on myself, I would probably say Nurse Ratched.
Oh, why?
Well, Annie Wilkes was more violent. She would, what'd she do? It took a sledgehammer to his ankles.
Yep.
So I mean, she did that and withheld food and did stuff to make his life miserable in a way to force him to do things, where Nurse Ratched was tough and stern, and but if you follow the rules within reason, you were okay. And I'd like to think I would follow the rules in a case like that.
Very good. You're making me question my own thought. I was thinking Annie Wilkes because she's crazy.
Right.
I think I can handle crazy, but Nurse Ratched was pure evil.
Well,
But
she
you
was,
make a good
right? She
point.
told you this is what you're going to do. Don't do this. And if you did that, she punished you, and she would punish you for doing things. Annie Wilkes was punishing you just because.
Just because,
So that to me is the difference.
right.
Poor James Caan didn't stand a chance,
Didn't say a chance.
but Jack Nicholson did. Right? If he followed the rules, he would have been okay.
Right.
Him breaking the rules, trying to be, him, Randall Patrick McMurphy there,
Right.
that was the problem. He thought he was outsmarting her where he couldn't in the cage.
Well, I thank you for playing along.
Oh, you're welcome.
And George, this was fun.
Yes, it was.
And thank you for venturing beyond the rotunda.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I really did enjoy that interview, and I hope you did too. And hopefully it inspires you to go read some of George Grosz's work. I do want to close this episode by doing my first ever book review in a segment I'm calling Pros and Cons. And since this is audio, that is spelt Prose and Cons. And sticking with the theme of this episode, we're going to review You Like It Darker by Stephen King. Now, I'm a big Stephen King fan. In fact, back in 2021, I decided to read all his fictional works in chronological order. And I believe there's like 65 of them. There are novels, novellas, and short stories. I've gotten through to date 35. So not too bad, but still some work to do. He seems to crank out a new book faster than I can read one, but we'll get there eventually. I particularly like his short story collections, which is exactly what You Like It Darker is. It was published in May of 2024 by Scribner, and depending on the edition that you have, it has about 502 pages. If you prefer to listen to audiobooks like I do, it is narrated by Will Patton and Stephen King himself and has a runtime of about 20 hours and 21 minutes. And I believe they're all worth it. The collection has 12 short stories in it. And my favorite is called The Fifth Step, which is about a newly retired man sitting on a park bench when he is approached by a stranger who asks if he could confess his sins as part of his alcoholism recovery. This story is quintessential Stephen King. It takes you on a ride, and you never know where you're going until you get there. There's another story called Laurie, which is about a rambunctious puppy and her new widower owner living down in Florida. And it's a heartwarming story, but it does have, to me, the most terrifying scene in the entire collection. And of course, there is Rattlesnakes, which is somewhat of a sequel to the 1981 classic Cujo, where we get to find out exactly what happened to Vic and Donna Trenton after that tragic day during that fateful summer. You Like It Darker touches on themes like death and grief, the dangers of misinformation and disinformation, and the manipulation of reality and dreams. It has all the usual Stephen King tropes. There are serial killers, aliens, ghosts, monsters of different types. It's a fun ride, and I give it 4.25 bookmarks. So after you finish reading George Grosz's A Look Inside a Mangled Mind short story collection, give You Like It Darker a try. I want to thank George Grosz for sitting down with me. I want to thank Maxile for providing us with our theme music. As always, I thank Natalie and Brendan for producing and editing. And most importantly, I thank all of you for listening. And I do hope you join me for the next episode where I will be talking with Kayla Allerton. Kayla and I have a few things in common. We both have a broadcasting background. We both are visually impaired, and we both are podcasters. Kayla is co-host to the Blind Spot podcast. So go check out that podcast and then come back to Beyond the Rotunda for our next episode. And until then, be well and enjoy wandering the stacks.